The Guardian is delighted to announce the launch of our new Global Development Professionals Network. It's completely free, and it's the place for global development professionals to share, discuss, and promote new ideas about the sector. With weekly newsletters, a first look at jobs, and live Q&As with global development experts. As a listener to this podcast, we're offering you the chance to win an iPad just for signing up to the network today. To find out more, head to guardian.co.uk/win the iPad.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, Mission Impossible. The Prime Minister heads to Brussels as the lone figure arguing for the most savage squeeze in the European budget and Britain's contribution to it. Will the Prime Minister wield his trusty veto once more? And would it work even if he did? Also this week, Breadline Britain. Rising food prices and falling incomes mean more cheap fatty foods, condemning those on the lowest incomes to ill health. The so-called nutritional recession is affecting more and more people in low-paid work. So why don't politicians seem to talk about it? And as hard-pressed families think twice about switching on the central heating this winter, is the government doing enough to keep the energy companies in check? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's Polly Toynbee, The Observer's economics editor Heather Stewart, and down the line, our friend and sage Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, David Cameron has arrived in Brussels with his one-man mission to slay the European budget. But despite the November weather, he's feeling the heat. The Conservatives lost votes to UKIP in last week's by-elections and Tory backbenchers are restless. For his own good, he'd better come back to Britain with more than the usual box of dense European fudge. Mike, let's turn this on its head and ask, how much does Europe really need Britain? In other words, how accommodating will the other countries feel that they have to be?
Well, we get the usual traffic in a negotiation like this. We are assured that the Germans are fed up with this. The French are fed up with this. Did a broadcast with a French journalist the other day who said the really interesting story in Europe is falling out between Britain and Germany. It goes all back to 1945, you know. Oh, really? But the story in Europe is always basically about the Franco-German axis. And, you know, that's in difficulty too in different ways. These are tough times for everybody. So the short answer to your question is they need us as much as we need them. They are fed up with us, but hey, I'll let you into a secret. We're a bit fed up with them. They created a currency which wasn't very well designed and has caused immense trouble to them, but is causing quite a lot of trouble to us. So, as usual, it's a negotiation, and Britain is not without allies in Northern Europe in trying to check the growth of the EU budget at a time when everybody's domestic budgets are being hugely cut. It's a legitimate point of view, but at the end of the day, on all sides, this is as much about symbolism as it is about money. And David Cameron's domestic politics is he's got to look tough for his Eurosceptics. But we're always in danger in Britain of forgetting that other people have similar agendas at home, similar perspectives, and nobody loves the European Union as much as they did when the good times rolled.
So I think, Polly, Mike saying that every European family is unhappy in the same way, and that might give grounds for finding a way through.
Well, maybe, but the sort of people we've relied on, or at least Cameron has relied on, like the Poles, are actually on the other side this time because the Poles have a big agricultural sector and they get lots of money out of the EU. What's been interesting is the retaliation, which we should, of course, have expected. I mean, it makes sense for us to say the budget should be frozen. Why should it be rising when everybody else is tightening their belt? But, of course, the riposte was, oh, I see, if you want the budget to be lower, to be less, well, let's start by cutting Britain's rebate for a start. And, of course, he immediately backs off that. So every country has what it wants to hold on to. I mean, we can point to the Common Agricultural Policy and say it's crazy because, for one thing, it pays our Queen £314,000 a year. It pays our biggest landowners vast sums of money that we shouldn't be paying them. So there must be room for manoeuvre here, and the chances are it will all be sorted out. There'll be a bit of a grumble from Tory backbenches, but it's not going to be a crisis.
But this time last year, Polly, David Cameron made a great show of wielding his veto. And, you know, a year on, we can say, what exactly was it he vetoed again? Did something that wasn't going to happen? And it's a bit unclear, but he did get a bit of a bounce at Christmas, and heaven knows he could do with one this year. Isn't that going to encourage him to just push this as hard as he possibly can?
I suppose so, as long as it doesn't, you know, reverberate against us. I mean, they could just, you know, what if they do take away our rebate? You know, it's got to be give and take. He's not in all that strong a position because he hasn't got very many allies.
What do you think, Heather? I mean, do you think there'll be consequences, either on the budget itself or on other issues, if he plays too hardball here? Or do you think it's
I think this is a much more serious issue politically for him than, I mean, in the European context, than what we were talking about last time, which was to do with regulation of the city and so on, you know, which is obviously a talismanic issue for us. But he certainly, by vetoing that, he wasn't bringing the whole operation of the EU to a halt. Whereas by attempting to veto the whole budget process, he would certainly look as if he was holding the rest of the EU in contempt. You know, he's ready to bring the whole House of Cards down, and that doesn't seem sensible.
Mike?
That's the pose he's striking, though. I mean, I think you're right, Mike, he can't really do that, but you know, that would be the sort of political pose he would be striking by saying that, wouldn't it?
Well, that's what makes the Eurosceptic position so stupid. That's spelled S-T-U-P-I-D, if Bill Cash is listening, because they'll roll over the budget on an annual basis, and that'll probably involve more expenditure than David Cameron would settle for this weekend. He doesn't have the power to veto it any more than he had the power 12 months ago to veto something which went ahead anyway, the fiscal pact, I think. And, you know, it's politics, but they all play politics. So we're naive if we think other people don't do the same. Is we paid a net contribution of 7.3 billion, I think it was last year. Only the Germans pay more. The French have only, after 50-odd years, begun to be net contributors. They've done bloody well out of it. Everybody knows it, including them. But they get all pious about being communautaire. Being communautaire means looking after French interests. It always did.
I mean, how do you think it would play out, though, Heather? I mean, if clearly Cameron's going to walk away from this trying to look like he's been very grand and he's stopped something happening. He's almost got to do that. He's not in a strong position, is he, after lots of votes for UKIP last week and the Conservatives losing a by-election?
Well, I think Polly's right that we'll end up with some sort of negotiated agreement, and it certainly looks this morning out of Brussels that there are reports that Herman Van Rompuy has come up with some sort of suggestion of reducing the budget by an absolute sliver over this year, you know, by sort of less than 10 billion euros. But in principle, that would be enough for Cameron to be able to say, well, you know, they were asking for an increase and it hasn't happened. We've had a reduction in the budget, you know, and whether you've got a reduction in the budget or not depends on which year you take as your baseline and all kinds of cheeky things like that. So, I mean, I think he's quite likely to come back with something that he can just about say is a semi-victory at least.
But there are parts of the Conservative Party, aren't there, Polly, that will not be happy unless other bits of Europe are visibly unhappy.
Well, I don't think they can grumble much. If he comes back with a freeze, let alone if he comes back with a slightly reduced budget, they can't complain. I think they'll probably choose the opportunity to say, look, that shows what we can do. And I don't see a great row developing on that.
And Mike, have you picked up on these rumours this week that David Cameron is working on, maybe even circulating a draft of his own version of the Bruges speech, something to reset the relationship with Europe in earnest?
Well, he is, but it's been put off quite a bit. And I think I read somewhere yesterday or somebody told me that it'll probably be in early December or possibly mid-December or possibly even just after Christmas. But what we do have in our hands this week is a speech made on Monday by Ed Miliband to the CBI in which he attempted to recalibrate it. I read it yesterday. It wasn't a brilliant speech. It's not going to go into the anthologies. What he said is we have to be pro-European. We'd be crazy to lose out on our best market in which we are. It is so important. And even if we left like the Norwegians or the Swiss, an absolute fantasy, incidentally, we're not Norwegians or Swiss. We don't have any mountains. And even if we left, we'd end up having to pay a lot in, not set the rules. But we have to address, if we're going to be pro-Europeans, and we in the Labour Party are these days, we weren't a generation ago, of course, he didn't say that, then we have to address the weaknesses of the EU. And one of them, Polly touched upon it, is the design of the Common Agricultural Policy, no longer fit for purpose, so that Her Majesty the Queen gets more than the average Welsh hill farmer, and that's all wrong. But Tony Blair tried that, and Cameron will certainly say Blair gave away a great chunk of rebate in reform for an alleged promise to reform the farm policy in, I think, 2007 with that scoundrel Jack Chirac, and nothing came of it, not much anyway.
And of course, grandiose buildings in Brussels don't help. Building some sort of insane...
They help the Belgian construction industry.
Well, terrific. What about our construction industry and everybody else's?
Absolutely.
And of
right.
course, the mad system of Parliament travelling between Brussels and Strasbourg, which is unbelievably expensive. There are some basic things that really are an affront, even to people
Remind
like
me again,
myself.
Which country is Strasbourg in? No, it's in France. Gosh.
Very nice place. But, Polly, it's not going to get resolved, is it? I mean, everyone can see that that's ridiculous. Everyone can see that, you know, Parliament shouldn't be... You know, we talk about expenses in this country and second homes, but maybe if you're an MEP, you need a third home or at least a third hotel to deal with this ludicrous situation. But it's not going to get resolved, is it? Because there is no mechanism, there's no decision-making forum in which arguments can be won or lost on their merits and then get through. That's the whole problem.
Well, I suppose at some point, that looks unlikely, a French president could put it on the table in exchange for other things. Maybe the parliament itself could get tougher about it. But at the moment, no, it looks pretty deadlocked.
Heather, we've been talking here, as Mike's been emphasising, about the European budget, the only thing that the Conservative Party cares about just at the moment. But it is important to put the numbers we're talking about in context, isn't it? Because we're talking about percentages of a small percentage of national and European income, it's the sort of small change quite often associated with local government, isn't it, once you average it out across the population?
Yeah, it is. Because we give a lot, but we get a lot back. So our net contribution is not enormous. So it's a political row, really, rather than an economic one. We're certainly not, none of these countries are in a position where they can't, you know, Germany's not in a position where it can't afford its contribution. We certainly aren't, and nor are any of the other wealthy states. But it's about, you know, whether the money's well spent and you know, ceding power and sovereignty and all kinds of other things. And, you know, in some sense, it's not really about the money, I think.
How do you think the numbers are looking in the bigger game, then, of whether or not the euro is going to trundle along? I've read a couple of comment pieces recently with people kind of saying, here are four or five reasons the euro might not fall over, which is a bit different from things we were reading a few months ago. Beginning of the end of the crisis?
It would be nice to think so, although the inability of the Eurozone finance ministers again this week to make an agreement to release the latest tranche of the much delayed tranche of money to Greece suggests that there are still kind of fundamental problems in agreeing how to tackle these issues. I mean, I still, it's not over, I don't think.
It doesn't look like it. The Greek, you know, the sum of money for Greece is tiny.
Absolutely.
Insignificant. And yet they still can't agree to give them the money and to let them try and establish some form of growth for fear of the moral hazard of, right, that means up come Portugal, Ireland.
It's a payday loan.
Italy and
that's
and
exactly
Spain.
What it is, Mike. You're exactly
it's
right.
It's von Wonga, the German lender. Von Wonga.
That's
is
exactly right.
Squeezing those Greeks. It's terrible. And, you know, I want the euro to succeed because I can't think of a better thing to do at the moment. We'll all go down with it.
Mm.
But it's pretty grim and the prospects are grim, I'm afraid. And Heather's quite right. This is a symbolic political row. Oh, dear.
OK, let's leave Europe there on a customary kind of oh, dear note. You can follow the talks on the budget unravelling or unfolding, I should say, at guardian.co.uk/politics. But for now, if you were to listen to speeches by Ian Duncan Smith, and some people do, you might get the idea that the simple answer to escaping poverty is to get a job. The reality is increasingly different. Growing numbers of families who are dependent on welfare top-ups are in fact in jobs already, and the majority of children who are in poverty now come from working homes. Some special reports this week by The Guardian with the Joseph Rowntree Foundation have found that raising food prices are taking their toll on the health of the poorest people in the country. Polly, you've written a lot about low-wage Britain in the past. If you've got a working parent, but it's a working parent on the minimum wage, do you think you can assume you'll get enough to eat?
No, plainly not. The minimum wage doesn't begin to cover it. They have to be topped up with tax credits, but tax credits have been cut. And they're being cut directly, but also invisibly, as year after year, they'll shrink. as the basis change from RPI to CPI, which is a hidden switch, which the Institute for Fiscal Studies says is the big cut in benefits over the next few years. But nobody can quite see it happen. What happens is their incomes fall further and further below the rise in prices, and particularly food prices and energy prices. And these families are in dire straits. Housing benefit bill is rising hugely. Again, nearly all the new people on housing benefit are in work, but not earning enough. And the government is committed to cutting the housing benefit bill, and yet it's rising fast. These are desperate times. And the sad thing is that if you're not a Guardian reader, the chances are you know very little about this. The BBC reporting has been dreadful, virtually non-existent. I haven't seen Mark Easton around at all on these poverty questions. And none of the other newspapers seem very interested. Well, The Independent a bit from time to time. So that it still hasn't really got into the public consciousness. And there's always a danger that Guardian readers, they ought to pick up a Daily Mail out of the bin from time to time and have a look at it and see how this agenda isn't anywhere else. And we wonder at what point it'll reach a wider national consciousness.
It's interesting, though, isn't it, on these things, Heather, ahead of the autumn statement, there was well-entrenched George Osborne discourse about Skivers versus Strivers. He might try and develop that in the autumn statement, or do you think he'll be a bit chastened because of what happened last year when it wasn't Skivers versus Strivers in the budget, it was the rich versus the rest?
I think he does need to be very careful. I mean, he's likely to give us more of a sense of how he's going to go about achieving £10 billion worth of benefits cuts, which is you know, harsh. It's very difficult to do without doing quite radical things. For example, like reducing the housing benefit bill considerably, which you can only do by, you know, imposing considerable misery on people, it seems to me. But the Tories still seem to be stuck in this rhetoric of you know, people getting up to go to work in the morning and the guy upstairs has got his blind still pulled and hasn't set his alarm clock, and, you know, because he's, the implication being he's too lazy to go out to work. I mean, I actually think it's the wrong message they're sending, because actually, you know, as you say, a large proportion of the people in poverty are getting up in the morning. Their alarm is going off. They are lifting up the blinds and going out and working bloody hard and still, you know, not managing to make ends meet. So I think they're in quite serious danger if they try and use that kind of rhetoric to justify, you know, much steeper benefit cuts.
The trouble is, it's working. That all of the opinion polls show that the one policy in which the government is miles ahead and very popular, in fact people want tougher cuts, is on benefits.
But will that continue to be true when it actually starts to bite on people, though, do you think? I mean, which it hasn't really, has it? I mean, it has to some extent, but there are much larger cuts coming down the line.
What do you think?
Next April, that's the
indeed,
crucial time.
Indeed.
It'll be in the few months after next April, when, for instance, the bailiffs start knocking on the door asking people for the 20% of council tax, which had been covered before, and now people who've never paid it, you know, it's a poll tax-like situation. And then I think maybe it'll hit the news.
What do you think, Mike? Do you think the...
Well, I think that this is what in politics we call a dilemma. Everybody's boxed in. The Daily Mail, as Polly said, stresses the Skivers, and the Guardian stresses the Strivers. They're hardworking people who do set their alarm clocks and do struggle. The working poor has been a problem for welfare policy for at least 400 years. Do you subsidise the wages, or do you force wages up and then risk the possibility that people won't get employed? It's an aspect of the argument about the minimum wage. And of course, then there are Skivers and Strivers among the rich as well. I was amazed a few weeks ago when one of the newspapers reported that somebody in the money business had earned 150 million or 120 million last year and paid £50 million in tax without complaint and said, I owe it to my community to pay my fair share of tax. You'd have thought his name would be on lights all over the country, but it isn't. So we ignore some of the rich Strivers as well as the poor Strivers. I've forgotten his name, I'm afraid to say, but I was astonished it didn't get more attention. It's awful. There aren't enough rich people to fill the gaps. And before you say close the tax loopholes, governments always close tax loopholes and they're always reopened again by smart tax lawyers. Fact is, Gordon Brown created an elaborate tax credit system to address these problems by incentivizing the working poor, giving them enough money to make it worthwhile, giving them a better standard of living. And it turned out that a lot of those taxes disappeared when the banks went bust. And we're struggling to to close that gap. And it's awful, and it's going to go on being awful, but it isn't quite as awful as it is in Greece. Perhaps it will be, and then people will notice, and then Heather's question may be answered when there are beggars in the streets and more riots. I hope not.
The question is who it's awful for. I look at myself. As far as I can see, I haven't been touched by anything. I still get my free bus pass. I still get everything. Nobody appears to have come after me for any money, whatever. Here I am writing about people on benefits being squeezed beyond what's bearable. And until I feel it myself, I will never believe we're all in this together.
They have come up to you a bit, Paul, without going into details, but you've got sufficient of a cushion, financial cushion I'm talking about, of course, sufficient of a cushion to not to notice it much. But Heather will explain after the programme what they've done to you. But you're right, not much. You can take
they took
the
away my free swimming, that was all.
That was on my list, not a very important one. Of course, you and I don't have to claim our free bus passes, but some strange reason we do, and you know, I value mine. I pay a lot of tax, and the free bus pass is one thing, and I sort of gives me childish pleasure. I've used it this morning.
The childish displeasure that's coming up, Heather, is the removal of child benefit from higher rate taxpayers at the start of next year.
Yeah.
How do you think that will work? I mean, there's big questions about the administration and whether the revenue is actually going to know who's got a kid and what happens with people who aren't married and so on. But beyond that, when you've got someone on £50,000, £60,000 a year who loses their child benefit, mm-hmm. do you think that they'll think, I didn't really need that money?
People aren't like that. It's not human nature. They will look at two couples, a couple earning 80,000 between them, and say, why do they keep it under the Chancellor's taper rules and I lose it? You know, we're all selfish in our own ways, and that'll cause Osborne a lot of grief.
But do you think
you can see why he's doing it? You can understand why he's trying to do it, but people aren't grateful, I'm afraid, for
But Heather, do you think that it's going to increase sympathy with people who are suddenly having, you know, at the bottom end of the pile, who are suddenly having to pay a bit of council tax or whatever? You sort of say, oh God, you know, Osborne's kicking us in the shins as well. Or do you think it won't?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I'm not sure the extent to which people on you know, 50 grand a year plus. I think they'll probably think, God, this is awful, I'm struggling, but I'm not sure whether they'll necessarily read from that, you know, gosh, and isn't this benefits cap a dreadful thing? It would be very nice to think that they would, but I'm not quite sure how much that'll help, to be honest.
Do you think, Polly, on that benefits cap, I mean, it's one surprise that Osborne could pull out of his rather tatty autumn statement hat would be to say the £26,000 that I announced was going to be the cap on any family's benefits will now only be £20,000 or something. That'd be enormously popular with his own party. But we saw sacked Minister Sarah Tether at the weekend saying it would be dreadful as far as the Lib Dems are concerned. Are you going to be looking out for that?
Well, I wish she'd said it when she was in office. It's all very well once you sack to suddenly find your bravery. She could have had huge influence as children's minister, standing up for what's happening to poor children.
She would say she abstained
abstained on one vote, but you look at what she voted for, and I don't think she makes a terribly good witness. Still, I suppose, better late than never. But no, I think if he cuts the cap down to maybe by then, Zoe Williams wrote a very good piece today about the cowardice of the children's charities. I think they might find their voice and speak up, because although it sounds great, you know, it sounds terrific, the real damage to families in expensive areas, mostly in the south, but also Cambridge and, you know, other expensive areas, would be just crippling.
Heather, as well as benefits, which we know about the misery on, there's also fuel bills. This week, the government said it would do something about fuel bills. It wasn't quite the same as what David Cameron said he might do the week before. Just fill us in on that.
Well, something, it's not quite clear what, I think. I mean, everyone knows this is a market that works incredibly badly, you know, where consumer choice was supposed to be a great boon for us all. And in fact, it's fiendishly complicated to try and work out which is the cheapest tariff for you, which is the right one for you, whether you're getting good value for money. You know, I am one of those rare people who does check the tariffs every year and find the cheapest and switch. And every time I've done it, it's been the most nightmarish process involving call centres and everything else. But what the government seems to be suggesting is that is that the firms will have to slash the number of tariffs they offer down to four and suggest to each customer what the cheapest one will be for them. But it's very hard to see whether that will actually stoke genuine competition. It might make things more transparent for people, but it's hard to see whether it will really stoke genuine competition between one provider and another.
Polly, isn't this exactly what they did with the trains a few years ago? You used to have 101 types of tickets and now you just have advance any time and off-peak or whatever. And it does sort of feel a bit calmer now when you're buying a train ticket, at least. It's a bit easier to budget.
Still incredibly expensive, though.
Well, also, huge differences whether you buy it online in advance and so on. I find train tickets very confusing and very strange how big the gaps are and what you can pay. It's plainly, you know, the idea that everybody can be on the lowest is like saying everybody can be average. It's just not possible, I don't think. So one way or another, something's going to have to give.
So maybe, Mike, everyone can be on the lowest tariff, but only if the lowest tariff goes up.
Yeah, it worries me that the Labour government and this government have been very indecisive about securing energy supplies, and the energy companies, the Big Six, exploit their differences quite ruthlessly, both in terms of the way they manipulate wholesale and retail prices, and the fact that they say, you know, the gas will be cut off unless we secure our supplies. We don't have enormous reserves to store gas in this country, and we're faffing about over renewables and nuclear. They're not exactly as if they're new policies. Our energy policy being awful, and in 10 years' time, a lot more people could be in trouble, and it'll be the fault of successive governments. I hate it.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. So before the lights go out, we really are going to draw things to a close. My thanks to Heather Stewart, to Polly Toynbee, and to Michael White, the producer. Was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to sign up for free to The Guardian's Global Development Professionals Network, and you could be in with the chance of winning an iPad. Find out more now at guardian.co.uk/win the iPad.